The Senate votes down a measure to dismiss the Trump impeachment, but only five Republicans voted to move forward with the trial. The question, is this a sign that Trump is headed for another acquittal? Plus, the president announces a deal to help speed up the slow pace of vaccinations. The question is, when can states expect more doses? And the Baseball Hall of Fame class of 2021, empty, with not a single player winning the votes needed for induction. The question, will they have better luck next year? It's way too early for this. Good morning and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that always aims to bat 1,000. I am Casey Hunt on this Wednesday, January 27th. We will start with the news. The Senate has signaled that the effort to convict Donald Trump is likely to come up short. Yesterday, only five Senate Republicans voted to move forward with the impeachment trial, joining Democrats in voting down Senator Rand Paul's measure to dismiss the case because Trump is no longer in office. If Trump is to be convicted for inciting an insurrection, 17 Republicans would need to join all 50 Democrats. And yesterday, the only Republicans to do so were Senators Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Mitt Romney, Ben Sasse, and Pat Toomey. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is reportedly undecided on whether to convict, voted that the trial is unconstitutional, even though he refused to reconvene the Senate early in order to begin the trial before Trump actually left office. Senator Rob Portman later said his vote declaring the trial unconstitutional was in favor of debating the issue and not a signal of whether he would vote to acquit. Here are the arguments that we are hearing from Trump's supporters in the Senate.
If the accused is no longer president, where is the constitutional power to impeach him? Private citizens don't get impeached. Impeachment is for removal from office.
A trial of a former president is simply vindictive. It will divide. And the question when we vote on this in a couple of hours for every senator should be, is it wise? Is it the right thing to do? I think from that standpoint, the choice is very clear. It will not heal. It will not unite. Let's put an end to this now.
And this is not driven by the needs of the country. This is not driven by trying to help out the people who are hurting back home. This is driven really by the partisan rage and the partisan anger the Democrats feel. They hate Donald J. Trump, and they're engaging in an act that I think is petty. I think it is retribution. I think it is vindictive. And I think it's a waste of time.
It's always been unconstitutional in my view, and it was ill-conceived. The president of the United States was impeached in 50 hours without one witness being called, and he didn't have a lawyer. So one of the reasons we need to make sure this thing never goes anywhere is because I don't want to legitimize the impeachment process used in the House. I think it's a danger to democracy and the presidency itself.
I would just underscore that all of the arguments that you heard right there, they are all process arguments. They are not arguments about the merits of whether or not President Trump incited the insurrection that attacked the Capitol and put all of those people's lives at risk. Meanwhile, Axios is reporting that Senators Tim Kaine and Susan Collins are privately pitching their colleagues on a bipartisan resolution to censure former President Trump. That is according to three sources familiar with the discussions. The news comes as it's looking increasingly unlikely that 17 Senate Republicans will join Democrats to convict Trump in the upcoming impeachment trial. Axios notes that some Democrats are interested only if at least 10 GOP senators publicly commit to censure, which would ensure the 60-vote margin that would be needed to pass major legislation, including something like this, in the chamber. Joining us now is the co-founder of Punchbowl News, Anna Palmer. And Anna, I just want to stick with this censure idea for a second, because while, yes, it underscores the reality of the likely vote totals on conviction, censure, it's toothless. It's not something that actually has any real consequences. It's a tool that's designed to shame people. And if we learned anything about Donald Trump when he was in office, it's that he has no shame.
Yeah, I think this is just a reality, to your point, that impeachment isn't going to happen. And there are Republicans and Democrats who want this president to be publicly kind of taken to the woodshed, proverbial woodshed, I guess. But to your point, are there 10 Republicans? I don't quite know where the numbers stand on that. Clearly, there's not enough Republicans right now that are going to vote to impeach this president. Most Republicans are making those process arguments. They want to move on. It's bad for the government, bad for the country to have this play out. It is going to play out. That's going to happen no matter what. And so this is just, I think, a kind of plan B if and when impeachment fails.
Anna, what's your take on Mitch McConnell in this process here? Because he had signaled just last week that he thinks, and he said as much on the Senate floor, that the president played a role in inciting the mob. And he, to our knowledge, has not pulled back on that the way some others like Kevin McCarthy is sort of trying to quickly backpedal and get back into the president's good graces after some backlash. McConnell, though, did vote that this trial was unconstitutional, or he at least voted to continue talking about that point. Still, I'm not convinced that it necessarily answers the question about how he's going to vote on conviction. And do you think what he does still matters, even if they don't actually have 17 votes to impeach or to convict? Excuse me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what Mitch McConnell does, it certainly matters. I think it's very important. It would be a key sign of if he were to vote to impeach this president. I think, to your point, it is an open question where he ends up on this. I think, though, we have been hearing for the last week or so that there is significant pressure within the Republican conference for him not to vote to impeach the president, that there would be Republicans in his conference that would have a problem voting for him to continue to be leader and stay in charge of Senate Republicans. So I think this is really an acknowledgement and the tough position he's in, where he's said, yes, he does believe that the president had a role in inciting this mob, but he's also a leader and power is very important to Mitch McConnell. So we're all going to be trying to read the tea leaves here in the next couple of days to see, does he come out? He's a man of few words, but when he says them, they're very important.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And you are right. And he knows power politics better than anyone else. And to that point, one thing stuck out to me. Lindsey Graham yesterday, I was talking to one of my colleagues on the Hill, and he said that his concern is a third party. And I think it was clear to me he was talking about the threats from Trump to create a Patriot Party or some other entity to try and run candidates. And we obviously there have been many academic conversations had about the possibility of a third party in the United States that really never come to anything. Do you think Lindsey Graham raising this is just a way to appease Trump, or is it a serious potential threat that Republicans have to think about? Because if Trump were to try and break his supporters away, it would effectively mean Republicans couldn't govern in the majority.
I think it's a concern for Republicans because Donald Trump is all about Donald Trump, and he has been for the past 4 years. And so I don't think he's necessarily worried about the legacy of the Republican Party, the fact of whether or not Republicans can get elected, because if he were to start another party, that would basically mean that they would just be siphoning off votes from Republicans in the next coming elections. It would make it very difficult for them to try to get back the majority in either the House or the Senate. We have heard that some of the Trump allies have signaled behind the scenes that he's not going to do that, but it is definitely an open question. You've seen Republicans like Ron McDaniel and Lindsey Graham try to publicly signal to the president, no, that would be a very bad idea.
All right, Punch Bowl News, Anna Palmer, no shortage of things to talk about this morning. Thank you so much for being up early with us. I really appreciate it. And the Biden administration is seeking to step up the amount of COVID vaccine doses on hand by 200 million in the push to inoculate most Americans by the end of the summer. The president announced the pending deal with Pfizer and Moderna during a COVID press briefing yesterday.
And we believe that we'll soon be able to confirm the purchase of an additional 100 million doses for each of the two FDA-authorized vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna. That's 100 million more doses of Pfizer and 100 million more doses of Moderna, 200 million more doses than the federal government had previously secured, not in hand yet, but ordered. We expect these additional 200 million doses to be delivered this summer. That increases the total vaccine order in the United States by 50%, from 400 million order to 600 million. This is enough vaccine to fully vaccinate 300 Americans by end of the summer, the beginning of the fall.
So these additional doses would make the U.S. less reliant on upcoming vaccine approvals for those from Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, which the Trump administration had been gambling on to continue the vaccine rollout. This is going with the sure thing. And the global coronavirus case count has now exceeded more than 100 million as the pandemic continues to spiral out of control. The United States alone makes up about a quarter of the total cases worldwide. And meanwhile, the United Kingdom is now the first in Europe to surpass 100,000 COVID deaths. Prime Minister Boris Johnson called it an appalling and tragic loss of life, and that it's hard to compute the sorrow contained in that grim statistic. It certainly is. And still ahead here, President Biden makes his first phone call to Russian President Vladimir Putin and confronts him on several issues. We're going to dig into what he said. Plus, the latest on Senator Patrick Leahy's health after a brief visit to the hospital last night. We'll have those stories and a check on your weather.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more. It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
When we come right back. Welcome back. Time now for sports and the message from the Baseball Writers Association to Hall of Fame candidates. Better luck next year. For the first time since 2013, no players were elected for enshrinement at Cooperstown, with all 25 of this year's finalists falling short of the 75% vote threshold. All-time home run leader Barry Bonds and seven-time Cy Young Award-winning pitcher Roger Clemens appeared near the top of the list, each with almost 62% of the vote. They seem to be plateauing around that mark in what is perhaps a reflection of Hall of Fame voters' posture toward players mired by baseball's steroid era. Pitcher Curt Schilling was the ballot's top vote-getter with just over 70%. Still 16 votes shy after seeing his share climb from 45% in 2017 to 70% last year. His support may be limited by his decision to broadcast controversial political beliefs, including a since-deleted tweet appearing to endorse the lynching of journalists and other offensive social media posts that eventually got him fired as an analyst for ESPN. Most recently, Schilling expressed support for the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. And while the writers' ballots had been submitted prior to that date, some reportedly asked the Hall of Fame if they could withdraw their votes for Schilling. All three former All-Stars were in their ninth year of eligibility on the ballot, leaving them one last shot at the Hall of Fame next year. But Schilling now says he won't participate in the final year of voting and is requesting to be removed from the ballot. In a lengthy letter to the Hall, also posted on Facebook, Schilling writes in part, quote, "I'll defer to the Veterans Committee and men whose opinions actually matter and who are in a position to actually judge a player. I don't think I'm a Hall of Famer, as I've often stated, but if former players think I am, then I will accept that with honor." Okay. Meanwhile, the basketball world is mourning the loss of longtime NBA reporter and analyst Seko Smith, who died yesterday after a battle with COVID-19. a mainstay across Turner Sports platforms for more than a decade as an analyst for NBA TV, writer for NBA.com, and host of the Hangtime podcast. Smith began his career in Mississippi at the Clarion Ledger after graduating from Jackson State University in 1997. He also wrote for the Indianapolis Star and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, covering the Indiana Pacers and the Atlanta Hawks. Smith is survived by his wife and three children. He was 48 years old, far, far too young. All right, time now for weather. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Kerins for a check on the forecast. Bill, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, Casey. If you remember yesterday at this time, we were talking about the devastation from an Alabama tornado. We really weren't sure how bad it really was. We knew we had people that were injured and rushed to the hospital. Well, yesterday we learned that we had one fatality. A 14-year-old freshman at Fultondale High School died in his basement with his family when a couple trees landed on the house. His dad was also significantly injured in that accident. And just look at the damage. I mean, this was an EF3, 150-mile-per-hour winds that just roared through right before midnight in Fultondale, Alabama. Dozens of homes just destroyed and so many families' lives just upended. And it's actually amazing when you see that much damage that more people didn't perish in that nighttime tornado. So let's talk about what concerns we have now. We have this huge winter storm in the West Coast. We see one storm exiting in areas of the East. We still have winter weather advisories that are up for areas that don't get a lot of snow. So today, careful driving in areas from near Kansas City, St. Louis. We'll see snow developing towards Lexington and Louisville, the Nashville area. Just to the north, you could get a little bit of snow, and then eventually into North Carolina, and then a huge monster storm in the west. So here's what we're dealing with. Just a little bit of leftover snow in the northeast. Roads are definitely slippery all through New England and areas outside of New York City and D.C. You can see that next storm bringing snow already to Kansas City and Missouri. That's the one that will move today through areas of southern Indiana, Kentucky, and also there through North Carolina. Not a lot of snow, but enough to make roads slick, about 1 to 3 inches. Now let's talk about this huge storm in areas of the west. This moisture that is coming into areas of Southern California is ridiculous. We are expecting the possibility of 6 to 7 inches of rain. That's rain in areas of coastal California. So we're worried about flash flooding, debris flows, especially any areas that have any burn scars. And then the snow is going to be epic when we get these pictures in. Now, again, this is at the high elevations where the ski resorts are, but that's feet, 3, 5, you get the pink. That is 7 feet of snow in the next couple of days in areas of the central Sierra Mountains in California. And on top of all of that, we've also got high wind warnings too. So it's like blizzard conditions at the high elevation. So Casey, enjoy the nice weather today. D.C. to New York, not bad. Temperatures in the 40s. Considering all the bad weather around the country, I'll take it, and I know you will too.
I know. I would be excited about 7 inches of snow here in D.C. Forget 7 feet. And we're, of course, thinking of everyone who lost so much in Alabama. Bill Kerins, thank you so much. We will see you tomorrow morning, my friend. And still ahead here, we've got more fallout from the deadly insurrection on Capitol Hill. We are learning why it took the National Guard hours to be deployed and who's taking the blame for the response. We'll be back in just a moment.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Welcome back. Senator Patrick Leahy is back at home after being taken to the hospital yesterday evening. Leahy, who is 80 years old, is set to preside over former President Trump's upcoming impeachment trial. A spokesperson for the senator says a Capitol physician suggested he go to the hospital for observation out of an abundance of caution. He had been in his Capitol office earlier in the day and was not feeling well. Leahy went home after getting test results back and after a thorough examination. We wish him the best. And we are learning more about the failed military response to the U.S. Capitol siege. The Washington Post reports that the Pentagon restricted the D.C. National Guard commander's ability to roll out troops ahead of the January 6th riots. Major General William Walker said that after criticism of the D.C. Guard's response to the racial justice protests last June, the Pentagon took away his power to immediately deploy troops. So when Walker received a panicked call from the Capitol Police Chief warning that rioters were about to enter the U.S. Capitol, he needed approval from both the defense secretary himself and the army secretary. And this added to the delay in the response. Meanwhile, the acting chief of the U.S. Capitol Police told members of Congress yesterday that her agency, quote, failed to meet its own high standards as well as yours. And as the FBI continues to investigate the violent breach at the U.S. Capitol, the agency's top federal prosecutor expects indictments to be handed down as soon as this week. The Wall Street Journal reports that with the help of more than 200,000 tips, FBI agents across the country continue to build cases that some of the rioters carefully planned the attack. But these types of conspiracy charges are hard to prove. They require evidence that two or more people agreed to violate laws. Meanwhile, three alt-right groups are under intense scrutiny for their potential roles in the insurrection, including the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, that's a group largely composed of law enforcement and military personnel, and the Three Percenters, it's an extremist wing of the gun rights movement. Several members of these groups have already been charged, including three people who face the most severe conspiracy allegations that have been leveled so far. All right, still ahead here, a look at where President Biden's cabinet stands after the latest Senate confirmation hearings. But before we go to break, we want to know, as always, why are you awake? Email your reasons to waytooearly@msnbc.com or drop me a tweet at Casey. Use the hashtag waytooearly and we will read some of your best answers coming up later on in the show. To way too early. It is 5:30 here on the East Coast, 2:30 out west. I'm Casey Hunt. With overwhelming bipartisan support, the Senate has confirmed Antony Blinken as the new Secretary of State. Blinken has had a long history working with President Joe Biden. He previously served as his advisor, both in the White House and in the Senate, before becoming Deputy Secretary of State in the Obama administration. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin had their first phone call yesterday since Biden took office. According to the White House's readout of the call, Biden, quote, reaffirmed the United States' firm support for Ukraine's sovereignty. He also raised other matters of concern, including the SolarWinds hack, reports out of Russia placing bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, interference in the 2020 U.S. election, and the poisoning of Alexei Navalny. Of course, referring to the jailed opposition leader in Russia. The Kremlin described the chat between Biden and Putin as, quote, frank and businesslike, and noted that the normalization of ties between Russia and the United States would serve the interests of both countries. Joining us now, White House correspondent for Politico and an MSNBC contributor, Natasha Bertrand. Natasha, good morning. Thank you so much for being up with us this morning. Let's talk through this call between the President Biden and Vladimir Putin, and also the circumstances that surrounded it, because they clearly wanted to send a message about who they wanted to talk to before they talked to Putin. And he was clear throughout this entire campaign. They got a lot of cleaning up to do.
Definitely. I mean, this is obviously an extremely fraught period for U.S.-Russia relations. We're just coming off the heels of a massive cyber espionage campaign that targeted the federal government and private companies in the U.S. And this is something that the Biden administration has to reckon with directly, because many of those hackers, according to cybersecurity experts, are probably still burrowed into these networks. So to confront Vladimir Putin directly about this, per the White House readout of the call, was obviously something very important for the president to do. And this all stands in stark contrast to the first readout of President Trump's call with Vladimir Putin around the same time 4 years ago. It was more about prioritizing the fight against ISIS and cooperating with Russia on terrorism issues, and much more about cooperating with Russia as a partner in the international space. So this is clearly a very, very stark contrast with that. And it shows that the Biden administration is going to be tougher on Russia and certainly tougher on Vladimir Putin than the Trump administration was, at least when it comes to the rhetoric. There is also the, priority of the Biden administration to prioritize human rights. And that, along with that, goes the treatment of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader. This was not something that was really a key priority for the Trump administration. They did not hold Vladimir Putin accountable for the treatment of dissidents and journalists, for example. So I think this is all just marking a really strong shift early on from Biden and how the relationship with Putin is going to be.
Yeah, you point out the rhetoric question, and obviously, we have documented over the last 4 years President Trump's affinity for strongmen and particularly for Vladimir Putin. But are there additional policy steps that the U.S. is thinking about taking, that the president's team is talking about taking, that go beyond just how we talk about Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that we have not seen that yet. So the president has said that no options are off the table here. We haven't seen exactly how this administration plans to retaliate, if at all, for example, the massive cyber espionage campaign, because it's difficult because the United States does similar targeting of the Russians in cyberspace that the Russians did to the U.S. over the last year. So there's a question of how do you retaliate and make it proportional so that you don't escalate this cyber war between the U.S. and Russia. So that's one consideration that's being taken into account here in the administration. But of course, there is still the option of additional sanctions, which Biden has not taken off the table. There's the option of expelling even more diplomats and more kind of intelligence operatives from the U.S. Steps, frankly, that the Trump administration did take when it came to holding Russia accountable for malign activity, including poisoning, a Russian spy on British soil. So these are questions that they're going to have to confront directly, because holding Russia accountable for its malign behavior is going to be necessary as Russia continues to be aggressive in this space.
That solar winds hack, I think, going to be one of those stories that we're talking about for years to come. And it's going to take a while before we really understand the full ramifications of that. Politico's Natasha Bertrand, thank you so much for being here and getting up early with us. We really appreciate it. And still ahead here, how the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is honoring actress and activist Jane Fonda at this year's Golden Globes. Plus, ice cream for breakfast? One company is making that childhood dream a reality. We'll have those stories coming up next in The Cooler. Way too early. Back in just a moment. Welcome back. Time now for some of the things that we'll have people talking today. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association announced yesterday that actress Jane Fonda will be the recipient of the Cecil B. DeMille Award at this year's Golden Globes. The honorary Golden Globe Award is given to a recipient for their outstanding contributions to the world of entertainment. Fonda's known for her work in films like The China Syndrome and 9 to 5, as well as her work in television and past home workout videos, which sold over 17 million copies. I don't even think I need to tell you about that. And in a statement, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association president said in part, quote, "For more than five decades, Jane's breadth of work has been anchored in her unrelenting activism, using her platform to address some of the most important social issues of our time. Her undeniable talent has gained her the highest level of recognition, and while her professional life has taken many turns, her unwavering commitment to evoking change has remained." Past recipients of the Cecil B. DeMille Award include legends like Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, Harrison Ford, and Oprah Winfrey. This year's Golden Globes set to air Sunday, February 28th. And in the midst of a pandemic in the dead of winter, some days, I don't know about you, we just want dessert for breakfast, seriously. And this company finally making that possible. Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams unveiled its new everything bagel flavor yesterday to mixed reactions, billed as the flavor you never knew you wanted. Yeah, really. The combo features the staples of an everything bagel. sesame and poppy seeds, and even onions and garlic in a buttery streusel woven through a cream cheese ice cream. The new pint is part of their limited edition ice cream for breakfast collection, inspired by other morning favorites such as coffee with cream and sugar, skillet cinnamon roll, honey vanilla bean, and wild berry lavender. Okay. I think I might prefer just a straight up everything bagel, but you know, to each their own. And this, a rare sight in the desert, but snow came down in Tucson, Arizona yesterday, much to the delight of the city's largest residents. The elephants at the Reed Park Zoo were spotted frolicking outside all morning. Albeit brief, the herd took advantage of the winter flurry, while most of the other animals opted to view the storm from inside their heated shelters. It was an especially big day for baby Penzi. Oh my God, look at that baby elephant. The youngest of the herd, she was experiencing her first snow. Didn't really like it very much. Actually, she did like it quite a bit and wasted no time sliding and rolling around in the slush with her sister, Nandi. Sorry, I'm seeing this video for the first time myself. How cute is that? All right, still ahead here, the steps taken by President Joe Biden yesterday to advance his climate agenda. And as we go to break, let's take a look at this date in history. Back in 1973, the Vietnam Peace Accords were signed in Paris.
Secretary of State Rogers signed for the United States. This morning, the diplomats signed the peace agreement and three supplementary protocols describing the details of the ceasefire, supervision of the ceasefire, and release of prisoners of war.
Welcome back. President Biden is expected to sign a number of executive actions today that are aimed at furthering his climate agenda. Two sources familiar with his plans tell NBC News the actions include, but won't be limited to, elevating climate change as a national security priority, directing the federal government to conserve at least 30% of all federal land and water by 2030, suspending new leases for natural gas and oil development on federal lands and waters, creating a commission focused on environmental justice and green jobs, directing federal agencies to rely on science in their rulemaking, and convening a climate summit of world leaders on Earth Day in 2021. Last week, Biden reversed several Trump policies related to climate, including canceling the Keystone XL pipeline and rejoining the Paris Climate Accords. Joining us now, editor-at-large at New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells, and the title of his latest piece proclaims the war on climate denial has been won. David, good morning. Thank you so much for getting up so early to talk with us about this incredibly important topic. And first of all, big picture, what's the story behind the headline here and why does it matter in terms of actually making policy here in the U.S.?
Well, I think the last year has been an incredible one for climate, even though it's been sort of hard to notice in the midst of the pandemic. All around the world, global leaders from China to South Korea to Japan across the EU have committed to much more ambitious climate pledges than they've ever made before, than they were expected to make under the Paris Accords going forward. And that's because there's been an incredible renewable revolution. The death of coal has moved rapidly forward. And because of all the political pressure that's been put on these leaders by the protest movements all around the world, all of which has made the cost of truly denying climate change by forces like the fossil fuel industry, it's made that cost just impossibly high. And you really don't see anybody at any level of government in any sector in the of industry sort of insisting that climate change is no longer real. That's just the very smallest step that the world can take towards taking action on this issue. But it is something we are now farther along there than we were just a few years ago. And it makes the new fights much more consequential. And the stakes are right in front of us. And I think these actions that Biden is taking signals a new era for climate policymaking in the U.S. and is a part of this new era that we're seeing all around the world.
Yeah. So, David, I think it's a great point. And one of the people I pay closest attention to in terms of what may actually happen in a big way in Congress here is Mitch McConnell. And over the course of the Trump administration, he did acknowledge publicly exactly what you're saying, that there is, in fact, climate change and it is caused by humans, which as we know, shouldn't have been a debate for this long, but here we are. So my question for you, I do sense that there is some opportunity on Capitol Hill to potentially do something big on climate. There could be buy-in from the business community. There could be a lot of incentives for members of Congress to try and send money related to green energy back home. But obviously, some of these things really run into big political challenges. The Keystone Pipeline is a huge divisive question. There are some other things already, questions about drilling on federal lands that have angered some members of Congress. What do you think are the chances of something big happening on the legislative front?
My guess is that what we'll see over the next few years is piecemeal action. Bills here and there, appropriations being made, not a single Green New Deal style omnibus climate legislation, because that would prove too difficult to get through. But what could be achieved, not just on smaller scale legislative action, but also through regulatory action and through the work of agencies throughout the federal government, I think is not insignificant. It's not sufficient. It's not going to put the U.S. on track to, you know, do what it needs to do to avoid catastrophic warming, but it's so much bigger and more ambitious than anything that's been done before. And I think you saw a hint of that in the COVID stimulus bill that was passed at the end of last year with overwhelming Republican support that did allocate $35 billion in green energy spending, which again, it's, you know, it's Biden wants to spend $2 trillion on climate change. So $35 billion is not all that consequential. And yet the Senate vote on that bill, I think, was 96-3. I think we will be able, we will see actions like that being taken going forward, and we'll have to count our victories, our small victories where we count them. On the symbolic front, though, I think we're really making huge progress when we see Chuck Schumer talking about the need to declare a climate emergency on MSNBC. This is, he is an unlikely climate hero, and that is a quite dramatic action that nobody at his level of government has ever proposed taking before. So we're seeing real movement at a kind of rhetorical level, and we're waiting and seeing to see what the actions that will truly follow will be. The measures that Biden has put forward yesterday and today are a great first step, but, you know, we have to see more.
All right. New York Magazine's David Wallace Wells, thank you so much for being here. We'd love to have you back to continue this conversation. I think it's a really important one that we should continue to have over and over and over again. So thank you very much for your reporting. And earlier on in the show, we asked all of you, why are you awake? We got this tweet from Betty. Getting my first vaccine this morning. Can't sleep. Nervous. Very sensitive to meds, but I know it's something I must do not only for myself, but for others as well. Betty, we are so grateful to you, and we're glad that you are on your way to being safe and protected. Amber tweeted this adorable photo. She is up putting together her son's playroom, and she says he decided to get up and help. I mean, obviously he has to be there to see it all. It's what a cutie. And Elizabeth emails to say, I'm up way too early to get ready for my daughter's wedding today. Congratulations. We love you. Oh, that's adorable. Congratulations, Kate and Seffi. I hope I'm saying that right. Best wishes today. Have a blast. And we had to show this one from Morning Joe superfan Erica. She is up early taking care of her new puppy, who is named Mika Jo Geist. There's a lot of honorifics in there. I'm sure Mika Jo and Willie are quite grateful for that. It's a very, very, very cute puppy. So thank you guys all for being up and watching this morning.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.